You're listening to Faith for Normal People, the only other God-ordained podcast on the internet.
I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Together, 1st and 2nd Chronicles have ruined more attempts to read the Bible in a year than any other force on earth. And we can understand why. The Bible's retelling of the rise of the monarchy in the 10th century BCE to the end of the Babylonian exile in 539 BCE covers much of the same ground as 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. Gone is the battle between David and Goliath. Gone is a showdown between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And King Manasseh, whose wickedness provoked the Babylonian exile in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, he's not that bad. In place of high drama scenes featuring highly questionable but undeniably compelling heroes, 1st and 2nd Chronicles gives us genealogies and extensive descriptions of temple building and a God who gives second chances. If you've ever wanted to rewrite bits of the Bible for the times you live in, you are not alone. The writers of 1st and 2nd Chronicles have been there too. Set aside everything you think you know about 1st and 2nd Chronicles and join Dr. Aaron Higashi as he shows us why the most boring books of the Bible aren't actually that boring. That they are, in fact, among the most bold and daring books in the entire Bible. Out October 28th, get a free chapter download right now at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/chronicles. Ever wonder what parts of the Bible we're supposed to follow and which we aren't? Well, this is the last call to pay what you can for our October class, The Bible is Not a Rulebook, with our very own Jared Bias. Pay what you can means you can pay as little as $1 or as much as you want for the class.
Absolutely. We're going to look at different ways people think about the Bible as an authority to tell us right and wrong, how we're supposed to follow the Bible, and maybe how to shift our thinking about what the Bible is and what we're supposed to do with it. So I'll be teaching that on October 28th. From 8 to 9:30 p.m., so mark your calendars, and then go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/rulebook to sign up.
If you can't make it live, don't worry. All our classes are recorded, so you can still buy the class now and watch it back later. Again, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/rulebook to sign up.
And if you want to access our entire library of over 50 classes, exclusive Q&A sessions with Bible scholars, bonus episodes, and a community asking the tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
Hey, folks, today on Faith for Normal People, it's just me, Pete. I'm talking with Liz Charlotte Grant about the Bible and reading it and exploring it after old ways of reading it just don't make sense anymore and are not helpful, and exploring artistic approaches and midrashic Jewish approaches and all sorts of things. It was a great conversation. Now, Liz is an award-winning essayist, published in many outlets, and the author of the book Knock at the Sky, Seeking God in Genesis After Losing Faith in the Bible. And that's pretty much what we talked about in this episode. And just a quick housekeeping note, since I'm hosting today's episode by myself, there won't be a quiet time segment at the end, but I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation nonetheless, and let's dive right in.
I think the fact that the text isn't clear means that in a lot of ways, it's like God handed us poetic license. All of a sudden, we have an opportunity to demonstrate spiritual autonomy as grownups approaching the text, right? And so there are question marks that continue to surround this work. And so it's helped me a lot to think about the Bible as a whole, as a work of art. That just sort of opens up something for me as I approach this text.
We always recommend Shopify. It took us from an idea to a real business. We got set up, I think, in less than a day. With very little effort, we could just focus on the supply chains and the product development. Shopify gives us the ability to customize without the complexity. We can change something without introducing fragility or having to pay a developer. We're Thirsty Turtle, and we leveled up our business with Shopify.
Start your free trial at shopify.com/au.
Welcome to the show, Liz. It's great to have you here. I'm sure this is like number two or three on your bucket list for the rest of your life.
Absolutely, it is. Of course.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's get to it. Tell us a little bit about yourself and really what made you just say, I'm done with the Bible. Right.
Yeah.
Maybe we could start there.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I completely ditched the Bible. But I would say that I don't believe in it like I used to.
Okay. Do you get tired of it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like, okay. I mean, so talk about that. But some people think they're not allowed to.
I know.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think I ever was in that camp entirely. I wanted to like the Bible more than I did probably, but
yeah.
I've always been interested in the weirdest stories. So I think you're this way, Pete. I mean, otherwise, why are you studying the Old Testament, right? So the weird primordial humans and their interactions with this deity who comes out of nowhere, speaking in their minds or aloud, we're not always sure, are they on some hallucinogenic drug and then they meet the divine? Do they, there's all sorts of questions about the scriptures. Yeah. I didn't think that way when I was a teenage evangelical.
Right.
But I grew up in evangelicalism, Bill Hybels sort of seeker sensitive evangelicalism.
Right. Right. So
on the East Coast.
Yeah. But then what is it that, at what point did you consciously have in your mind sort of a shift thinking, I don't think I believe the stuff the way I used to. And was there anything that prompted that really pushed you towards that kind of a realization?
You know, it's so funny because I wish I could point to kind of one moment, but I think the fact is that my faith has been in evolution, evolving for a long time.
Yeah.
In college, I mean, I think I college was the first time I learned the word evangelical, even though I went to a private Christian high school. Uh-huh. And that was, that's
not a very good one, apparently. Not a very good Christian.
Apparently not. Yeah, no, it was more an emphasis on the private than the Christian side of the school.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I went to Wheaton College, and in my first theology class, they're using the word evangelical, and it's like, oh, that's what I am. We never thought to define it before. It was just, we're Christian.
Right.
And that's all there is to it, right? We're not Catholic. We're Christian.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I have students who don't know much about Christianity, and they have a Catholic background, and they say, well, I'm not Christian, I'm Catholic. And I'm saying, I wish you wouldn't say that. It just doesn't sound right to me. You know, your particular flavor.
Well, and it's not. It's not right. You know, as far as the history of Christianity. But I think one of the things that's so interesting to me is that I think as I started to become, I studied literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested in the literature element of the Bible. I was interested in the psychological realism of the characters. I was interested in the words and the artfulness of the text. And I don't really know if I ever read it like a good inerrantist should, because I wasn't interested in that sort of reading of the Bible. I was always a weird, arty kid. and so I think learning, okay, I'm an evangelical, I come from this background, just in college more opened up to me, and I read more, and I got in therapy, and that was a big thing, working through dysfunction in my family background.
Yeah.
And that allowed for me to recognize the ways in which the systems of my family, but also the systems beyond my family, have shaped my understanding of religion and faith and God. I was just seeing this a really different way than I had before.
Liz, that is very interesting. That's not a typical sort of deconstruction story, if that's even what we're going to call this, because you just started expanding your thoughts to different areas, and psychology helped you understand your existence and why people do what they do. And you didn't have a stringent, let's say, oppressive Christian upbringing, right? And you sort of didn't even know you were an evangelical until you got to college. And you went to an evangelical college with a good academic reputation. You just studied literature. But then you started expanding your consciousness a little bit about this text. And I'm guessing, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Liz, but I'm guessing that you found for yourself, there needed to be different ways of coming at this text that would speak to you.
Absolutely. It is very easy to fall back on the aphorism of reading the Bible plainly, right? That is an evangelical understanding of the Bible. The Bible is easy to read. God communicates clearly to us. God reaches out to us, right? The incarnation is, Jesus, God in human form, coming down to us. So theoretically, that would mean...
And that's easy to understand, too.
Right, that's easy. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, that was very easy for the disciples to understand, yeah, right, as we can tell.
Yeah.
This is a teaching that's hard to understand. I mean, I feel like that's a phrase the disciples are constantly throwing at, yeah, Jesus. They're like, what the heck does that mean? I just have no clue what this man is talking about. Yeah, I think, you know, so much of the Bible is like that. And I think there was a part of evangelicalism, there is a part of evangelicalism still that desires certainty above all else. Mm-hmm. And I think my background in the arts gave me a sense that that is just certainly not true. Like that certainty is not guaranteed to any of us, that safety, mm-hmm, is not guaranteed to any of us. And so then what do you do with that? What do you do with those questions, right, and those doubts and those curiosities?
Yeah.
I think I'm a generalist. I'm a columnist for the Christian Century. I'm not a seminarian, mm-hmm, you know? And so coming to the book of Genesis was intimidating to me, but it was also an interesting challenge, mm-hmm, you know, to be able to say, what does it look like to read this in a really different way? You know, to put, mm-hmm, other texts up against it, to take the Bible seriously as a document, mm-hmm, you know, with its history and context, but also to say, how does that interact with my life right now?
Right.
If it's not a science textbook, mm-hmm, what is it?
So, I mean, you came at it then, let's say, from an artistic point of view, which I think is, I mean, I want to say for everybody out there, that's, I think you almost have to do that if you're going to read these ancient texts, which are filled with mythic images, which are not analytical. They're almost archetypal, you know, kinds of things that, you know, when we look at them from that highly rationalistic point of view, I can imagine ancient Israelites saying, what do you mean? Like, there's a talking snake and a magic tree in this garden. Right. What other genre clues do you want me to give you that
you
we're
gotta
trying to tell
a story? You've got to believe, like, the Tower of Babel, like, they, mm-hmm, didn't expect that that was a direct history, right? Like, this is a question, what do we do with all the nations of people? How did this, mm-hmm, happen?
Yeah.
How are there all these tribes?
Right. And I think the to make the assumption, as you're making and as many people make, that, listen, I think we should assume going into the reading of this text that we're not going to be confronting what we call history. We would be accused of being subjective in that sense regarding the Bible, but the same question could be turned to literalists saying, you're making an assumption about the nature of this text that frankly seems to fall apart rather quickly once you start reading it. It just gets too odd and too weird. And, you know, but that's a matter of, that's a whole other topic. That's, you know, what's wrong with the evangelicalism kind of thing. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about specifically how you went at reading Genesis. And I know that I want to focus on something, at least at the beginning. A big word for you is Midrash. So, can you just give our listeners, some of them know what Midrash is, but a lot of listeners might not. So can you just give a little quick definition of that? Let's launch into how that helped you understand or read Genesis differently.
Yes, absolutely. I think the best image from within the Bible itself for me understanding the idea of Midrash is Jacob wrestling with God or the angel in the middle of the night. Getting in the dirt and rolling around and sweating and walking away with a limp. Mm-hmm. That to me is the archetypal imagery that, I mean, really, it gives me an entire lesson in how to read the Bible, I think. Mm. The Israelite, the Hebrew people, the Jews, you know, took their name from him, Israel. And part of that was this call that they felt to wrestle with God and to wrestle, mm-hmm, with this text. And I think for me, that has been a really like a North Star as I go into this text to say, you know, okay, parts of this text might be 4,000 years old. They might be older. You know, they might reference older works. They may, you know, they might not be that old, but certainly these are ancestral texts, right, that have been passed down to us, a library of opinions and poems and songs and faux histories, mythology about the beginning of the world and God's role and in that, and what mm-hmm, humans have to do with that at all. So a midrashic approach really kind of takes that idea of wrestling and commentary further, I think, than evangelicals often do, you know, because of the Enlightenment thinking that so often accompanies our commentary. We kind of, and this is not just evangelicals, right? This is modernism.
Right. Right.
We want to be able to categorize. We want to kind of pin down God on a board, like a butterfly, and study God from all angles. And it just, the Bible doesn't always work for us like that. Yeah. Right.
Right.
This is why I tend more toward a sort of biblical criticism, like a literary critic, you know, like biblical theology, rather than systematic theology, because I think when you get into systematics, all of a sudden you're kind of trying to create all these categories. They may or may not fit all of the text, right? So how can you be a little bit more flexible to the words in front of you?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Midrash, there's a couple different types in the Jewish consciousness, but the gist is there's sort of law Midrash, and that's a more straight exegesis of precepts, and it's more of the plain reading idea. But then there's this entirely different Agadic Midrash, and those are sort of the expansions, the exploration of white space, you know, the words between the letters and the sentences and in the margins. And so often it's mythological and it's rabbis arguing with each other often, you know, sometimes they're in conversation, sometimes they're arguing. I think sometimes because there's a mythological element to these stories, and I can give you some examples in a sec, but I think sometimes evangelicals think that that is false, or that it takes the scriptures less seriously. In fact, the Jewish understanding of the scriptures is very similar to evangelicals. You know, there's a sense of authoritative,
right?
This is the authoritative word from God. And they are desiring to understand it so deeply, even the parts that are confusing or, you know, about which the text is silent. You know, how did Abraham decide to hear the voice of God and just roll up his rugs and walk out into the desert, right? We don't know. But the Midrash says, well, maybe God had been talking to him beforehand. And there are all these mythological stories about Abraham encountering God as a baby and all sorts of things.
Yeah, just to be clear, so Midrash, at least in that sense, is filling in these silent gaps that people might have questions about. And you know, maybe a good example there too, just to mention it, is where did Cain get his wife from? That kind of stuff, you know, or, you know, why did God put a serpent in the garden when it was going to be such a problem? I mean, did he not know this would happen? Those are very modernist kinds of questions, I think, by the way. They're not Midrashic kinds of questions. But the thing is that the text is gapped. It's got the white spaces in between, right? And it's like, that's why it's a gift that keeps on giving. And people want to make sense of it for themselves.
I think so, too. I mean, I think the fact that the text isn't clear means that in a lot of ways we get, it's like God handed us poetic license. All of a sudden we have an opportunity to demonstrate spiritual autonomy as grownups approaching the text, right?
Yeah.
We're not kids. We, you know, we have this hard text in front of us. And especially, you know, because it's such an ancient masterwork, we don't know everything about it. And we just won't know everything about it because we weren't there. We don't have the same culture and history, geography, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are question marks that continue to surround this work. And it is a beautiful work, you know? And so it's helped me a lot to think about Genesis in particular, but the Bible as a whole, as a work of art. That just sort of opens up something for me as I approach this text.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Yeah, it's an angle that I think many people don't consider to be a valid one, because it's, like you said, it doesn't really lend itself towards the systematization of the text, which is, I think, a particularly Christian issue. It's not all Christians, but I mean, John Levinson, one of my Jewish professors in graduate school, said for Jews, the Bible is like a problem. You got to try to solve it creatively. For Christians, it's a message that has to be proclaimed. So we got to have the one message. And we tend to get very nervous with, I think, some rather obvious points that Jewish Midrash brings up for us. And let's explore that more in Genesis. You had some other stories. Before we get there, can I back up on one thing? I just, as a literary person or an artist person, the story of Jacob wrestling, do you have any thoughts, or does it not, maybe not matter to you? Do you think that the story was written in light of later, let's say, Israelite realities? Or do you think that was the older story that sort of gave rise to Israel's self-understanding? If that's not too confusing and odd a way of putting it.
That's a great question. Yeah. I don't know the answer.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah,
I do. But that's okay. You don't have to know the answer.
No. Tell me the answer, Pete.
I always suspect that the whatever was there in these ancient stories that were probably told and handed down, how old they were, no one really knows. But I don't think the Bible was invented in the year 1000 BCE or something. I think that these stories are much older. But we don't know what form those early stories were. So my default position on many of these things is what I'm seeing here, especially in Genesis, is writers reworking the ancient traditions in light of specifically the monarchy and then the Babylonian exile. And to me, as a critical scholar, that has always made the most sense to me. But I think that can dovetail and be in conversation with, let's say, more literary or artistic ways of understanding the text.
I mean, one of the things I love about that is this understanding that story changes, you know, that stories change according to culture and time and place and people. Yeah. Whoever is telling a story is going to tell it a different way. You know, you wouldn't tell the same story, you know, exactly how I would tell it. And I think that's fascinating. I think that is worth exploring, and it's interesting. That doesn't mean that a text isn't authoritative, which is kind of another, you know, and that term is tough in progressive spaces, because what kind of authority does this text have? You know, like we're not sure, and we're still trying to figure it out. You know, God speaks here.
Yeah,
that's what I believe. But can I tell you how?
Right.
You know, can I tell you what sort of God dust is sprinkled in the pages? Of course not. I don't know. I don't think any of us do. And I think when we try to fill in those gaps with certainty, we make mistakes, you know, and we end up kind of bludgeoning people, which is so often what Genesis has been. It's been this weapon of the culture wars, right?
Absolutely.
Instead of this kind of gentle, generous, interesting, generative work of art.
Right.
And I think, you know, in my book, listen, I'm not a scholar, which is why I appreciate you and the show so much, Pete, because you better believe I was listening to some of those Genesis episodes. But I
yeah, but you're here to be you, Liz. You're here to be you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
okay,
and bring the stuff that you do that I don't do, that other people do. So
I love
And that's the thing. Like, I mean, just to pause here on this. You know, I think being an academic helps you understand certain things that are of academic interest, like where does the Bible come from? How do the Israelites arise? But the Bible is the people's book, and there's no stopping that, right? It's always been the case. And people have said the weirdest stuff throughout history about the Bible. So have scholars, by the way. But it's a book that's meant to be engaged by people and by communities of faith, asking questions of meaning. And that's why Midrash is a thing in Judaism, because it's how do we make the text, how do we look at this text and bring it into conversation with our own moment, with our own existence? And the church has done that too. I mean, with great zeal, with reading Jesus all over the place, you know, in the Hebrew Bible, when he's, you know, in a technical, historical sense, not there, but everything is read in light of Jesus. And that's Christian Midrash. That's reading creatively and seeing how we can draw these two universes together. So, and I don't think that's the property of, let's say, professional exegetes or theologians. I just think that we have a background where we can add some substance to it and say, you know, I hear what you're saying, but that's been a big pitfall in the past. We might have to avoid this, that, or the other thing. So I mean this sincerely. You know, some of the biggest advances in biblical scholarship have been by non-academics. I mean, the whole thing about who wrote the Pentateuch was started in the 18th century by a doctor, literally a physician.
That's great.
Now, of course, he knew Hebrew, which helps.
Well, that helps. Right? Yeah, it
does. But back then, they didn't watch TV. They just did stuff like that. So
yeah,
so,
they were pretty bored. Yeah. Yeah.
That's why. So. And I've learned, and I continue to learn from people with no academic background. And I mean,
obviously, I agree.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote this book, right? Yeah. I think for me, the questions of historicity of, you know, who wrote what, when, those are not my questions. Right. Those are somebody else's questions. Mm-hmm. My questions are, why are we here?
Yeah.
And how has this text been read? And then how does that impact us as people even now? And so, you know, those bigger questions of the text, you know, what does God think of us? Why did God make us? I think so much about Genesis is focused around those questions. Like, you know, when the Hebrews were writing about the origin of the world, they wrote a poem. You know, they wrote a poem. That was the first thing. That's how the Bible starts, with a poem. But, and so
that annoys me so much because I don't like poetry. How dare the Bible? How dare the Bible not be legalistic and all that stuff in the beginning? Anyway, yeah. Right, exactly.
I mean, it gives us so much space, right? It gives us space to say, we don't exactly understand it. And we weren't there.
Right.
And there are questions that remain, right? And one of the things I've loved about physics in the past, say, 20 years, is that we continue to learn new and new things about the origins of the universe and realize just how little we know actually about the universe. I think the statistic is like, we know about 5% of the universe.
Right.
And we know a lot. Right.
and the more those smart people who do math,
right.
The more they study, the more that 100% increases. It's a bigger 100%, you know, so we know, in a way we know less and less. And for me, that's not, and that's why the Bible's right. We have to go back to the Bible because the Bible's certain. No, it's telling us something about, I think, what God is like. And and mystery becomes, I don't know for you, but mystery for me has become a very important word over the past maybe 15, 20 years. And I revel in that. I'm so happy that, like, I don't have a chance at figuring this stuff out. All we have is, well, not all, but what we have is this text compiled over probably a millennium or so of people's journeys of faith, of trying to articulate for themselves what this mystery is. And, you know, it's been said that the word God is a cloak we throw over mystery to give it a shape. I think Pete Holmes just said that in a comedy routine. But I think that's a brilliant way of putting it. And we're all in the same space. Now, what facet of human existence is going to be well-suited to ask questions of that mystery? And it may not always be the analysts, right? It's the artists who are, I think, more in tune with myth than many people are. They're asking about meaning and big questions, you know. And that's why I think this, I'm glad you did this. You know, it's, and I love the book. I even endorsed it, as I recall. So by the way, the book is, we haven't talked about that yet. It's this.
Oh yeah. Thanks for that, by the way, the endorsement. Yeah,
you're welcome. So anyway, that's the book, Knock at the Sky. And so anyway, and the way you're coming at it, this is the thing about authority. It's a kind of authority that you're taught because you want to understand the text and then bring it into conversation and to a deep conversation, even a challenging conversation with your existence. And other models of authority, I'd say, are more judicial models of authority, legal models of authority, which I think have their place for some things. But to think that the biblical text is exhausted by that kind of authority, I think ultimately that's what drives people away, because it just doesn't work for them. And not because they're weak, but because it just doesn't make sense.
Well, and it's an authoritarianism, an interpretative authoritarianism, right? There's one single way. And if you don't fall in line, then what does that mean about you, right? It's an issue of belonging then, right? Instead of, you know, what does this text invite us into? Mm-hmm. You know, what is God inviting us to here? What are our ancestors? You know, one of the things I love about what you said, you know, over a millennium, this was compiled. And then beyond that, mm-hmm. people continued to write and copy and hand it down to their children over and over and over again until it got to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some reason, we have this ancient text. Of course, parts of it, you know, we had to really dig up in the sand and try to piece together. And
right.
got to us pretty ragged, let's put it that way. Uh-huh. But the fact that these things were preserved at such great cost and effort,
yeah.
I think is worthwhile to ask, right. you know, when you think about, like, why would progressive Christians even still read the Bible? Our ancestors have something to say to us. You know, they found this text important. And so what can we find in this text of God and of ourselves? And I think that that's a motivating reason to keep reading.
Yeah. And you, it seems like you don't make a hard distinction between the Bible as the ancestors have something to say to us and the Bible, maybe God, the Spirit has something to say to us. Those two things, that's not an either or.
Yeah. I think they play together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do.
That's deep stuff right there, Liz. It is. That's really deep stuff you're saying there. So I think it's
part of that for me is, you know, I'm probably a natural charismatic, or at least I used to be. I don't know what I am now, to be honest. still figuring that out.
Yeah.
PCUSA, but that's kind of frozen chosen for me. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, the openness to mystery, to the unknown, to questions and curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think so many of the questions of our lives actually revolve around death, going kind of what actually happens then, you know, we ask questions about our origin because we're actually really curious about our death, right? Like, why are we here at all?
Right.
And what am I supposed to do with my time? And I think, you know, the openness in the Bible, the fact that it's not, and in Genesis, the fact that we don't know exactly the cosmology of the world, we cannot pin it down. I think that's very compelling and interesting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think being able to kind of draw in, you know, in my book, I draw in a lot of science stories and psychology, and I talk about the fine arts. I talk about silence. Mm-hmm. John Cage has a piece in which he sits at a piano and plays nothing for three movements. You can imagine how
books
that
like
went
that.
Down.
I've written books like that.
It's really great. Mm-hmm. It's very tempting.
Yeah.
Who will give you a book deal for that? That's my question. but I think, you know, some of these things that we experience in our own lives, they have something to say and kind of to be put in conversation with the biblical text. You know, that's kind of mm-hmm. one of my goals, is to allow you and invite people to kind of take their own experiences and their own inspirations and kind of put them next to this ancient text and say, how do these interact? And how, mm-hmm. you know, how does this feel differently with this story of dark matter right next to it? Or this, mm-hmm. you know, the third man syndrome, you know, how does that interact with the story of Jacob, for example? You know, who was Jacob wrestling with? We're not really sure.
Mm-hmm.
And does that intersect with some of these other things?
I think you would be told, let's say by loving evangelicals who like you and love you, but just disagree with you, not bad people, right? Who would say, it seems like you're letting your own personality and your own thoughts and your own intuitions and your own experiences really shape this whole thing. It has to be shaped by the objective word of God that tells you what you need to know, and then you have to fall in line with it. Not be in conversation woo-hoo with it, right? But actually to be in conformity, to conform yourself to what is written in the text. And I understand that. I know why people say that, and it's not the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, it makes some sense within certain parameters, but respond to that. How do you think through mm-hmm. that issue of, like, because people have heard, you know, I've heard from my kids, like, we heard in church all the time, you can't trust yourself. You can't mm-hmm. trust your intuitions. You can't trust your experiences. That's evil. You're sinful. Mm-hmm. We're not, because we're telling you how to understand this text, right? But, I'm asking you to talk about that, because that is such a big thing for people to almost feel like they're betraying God when they ask questions of meaning for them in this text. So how do you respond to that?
I mean, I have had concerned persons reach out to me, which I actually really appreciate because
I like the way you put that, concerned persons.
Concerned persons, genderless persons. I think it comes from a place of genuine concern. Mm-hmm. And so I can see that. I mean, the thing that's tough is we fundamentally will disagree at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Even if I explain myself well. So that can be challenging to know kind of what's their tolerance for agreement and disagreement. Mine is actually very high. Theirs might not be, right? Mm-hmm. I know you've experienced that, Pete, at Westminster and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. One of the concerns that people bring up is sort of a hierarchy of texts. You know, mm-hmm. when you're putting all these different things right next to the biblical text and interpreting not just from commentators, not just the biblical text, but kind of using these other stories to interpret the Bible, all of a sudden this becomes like, oh, this is a really, you know, postmodern, non-objective, highly personal accounting of God. And all of a sudden I'm a universalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not actually true of me. Mm-hmm. But I think there is this fear of eisegesis that comes up.
Right.
Eisegesis is very much, you know, reading like a personal reading of the text. And yet I think one of the things that I came back to over and over as sort of a guiding point for interpretation was this idea from Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg. Those who don't know her, I recommend every single one of her books.
Okay.
Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg. She is mm-hmm. a Midrashic scholar, mostly a scholar of Rashi, who is one of the most quoted of the rabbinic scholars. And she takes this eisegetical scholarship approach in her own writings and has done kind of writings on most of the Torah. She herself is Jewish. Mm-hmm. And she describes it. She says, my mode of inquiry was closer to the rhetorical than to the methodical in terms of Gerald Brun's distinction, the rhetorical having no greater ambition than to discover what can be said. And she suggests the aim of interpretation isn't merely to domesticate, to familiarize an ancient mm-hmm. book. It is also, and perhaps more importantly, to make strangeness in certain respects stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say, like approaching the text from an eisegetical point of view means that you don't really reading any text, you don't arrive at one clear interpretation. But the whole point is to muddy the waters, to actually kind of bring up the incorrect interpretations. So there's this sense of, you know, there's almost no, and in fact, I kind of believe that there's almost no wrong way to read the Bible, which uh-huh. I know is a heresy in most places. I would say the one wrong way is to read it as if it's meant to be a weapon against people mm-hmm. because it was meant to be a gift to us, mm-hmm. right? Direction right. and guidance and wisdom and presence, mm-hmm. right? And so when it's used as a weapon, I would argue that that's probably the one truly wrong way to use the Bible.
I agree with you that, and again, this is the kind of authority that the Bible has when you look to it to, and when you're done, you're not so much saying, and now I have unlocked the mystery and it is mine and I will now use it and tell other people about it. It's, I mean, not to sound sort of mamby-pamby, but it's, you're more left with a sense of like, oh boy. Wow. You know, I mean, they used to call that awe, you know, and it's an awe that isn't derived from, I now have unlocked the answer to everything. It's more, this is so much bigger than I ever could have imagined. And, you know, wouldn't it be ironic, Liz? I think this is sort of what you're saying, that the purpose of the Bible is actually not to give you to that narrow path where you will understand everything, but it's so convoluted it's so internally contradictory and weird. It's like, that's never even an option for us, you know? So how do we access this book in a meaningful way? And there are multiple ways of doing that. And I think, you know, your approach actually reminds me of the medieval period too. Yeah. Well, no, that is a compliment.
Mine's not very allegorical, you know, so that's the one downside, but
medieval interpretation, whether Jewish or Christian, you know, the literal meaning, so yeah, it's there, it's important, blah, blah, blah. It's also the most boring, you know, if you want this if you want the text to be relevant to you, you have to engage it on a very different level. You have to almost seek your answers in the text, what the text isn't even talking about it. So there's, maybe not allegorical, but a moral meaning, you know, like, how is this relevant for me? And how does this explain my existence?
Right. I mean, Genesis, you know, it genre-wise, there is a lot of history and narrative, at least. Let's say narrative. Yeah. Whether it's history is up for debate, right? But the one thing I would just add to that, I think I have also come to understand that the interpretive process is not an individual one. One of the things that I was really determined to do in this study was to seek out voices other than those that I had already heard. So let's say the dead white guys. Okay. Those were the ones that I was more familiar with from my training and background. And so I said, okay, I want to hear from anyone else. I am open to whatever that looks like. And I can kind of weigh it and disagree, but I want to put those other things in conversation because we have done such a poor job creating kind of a democratic reading of this book. Like the way that we have interpreted this book has a hierarchy to it. Like whose voice and interpretation matters the most? Who gets to say what the right interpretation is, right? This is kind of all the questions of inerrancy are kind of swirling around this idea of who has authority. You know, the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy is authority comes up. That word comes up 3 or 4 times in a few paragraphs. I mean, it's just the thing that they are thinking about is like, who is in authority? And generally it's them, right?
Right.
And I understand the appeal of that, but I'm here to say, I don't think that that is necessarily what the Bible is trying to do.
They'll say the authority is the text, but it very quickly comes down to their understanding of what the text is sort of metaphysically and what their understanding of passages are. It basically comes down to a systematic theology of that. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I can imagine some people saying, well, yeah, they're not the authority. They're seeing the Bible as the authority, but that's very slippery between those two concepts
because it's their way of understanding it. Yeah. It's not as clear as that. And sometime we can have a whole conversation about inerrancy, Pete, because you and I have talked in the past about that, and it would be fascinating to talk about that summit. I think, you know, it's just a challenge, though, when you think about how do you approach this text, not just as an individual, but in a community? You know, what does it do to kind of widen the table of interpretation and say, okay, I'm going to spend time with the womanists. I'm going to spend time with disabled theologians and queer theologians. I'm going to spend time with Black liberationist theologians, Latin American liberationists, right? And just to say, kind of, what do these different voices add to the discourse? What are we missing about this text? You know, if it really is this complex and wide, if it self within itself is an ongoing conversation, then what does it look like for us to mirror that approach in our current interpretation, right? I think that's what we see in the text. There's so many different voices, there's so many different books, you know, they disagree with each other about about things, they have conflict, they have issues with themselves, each other, God, everybody, right? I mean, there's so much conflict within the scriptures themselves. And I think that is a model for us. Right. You know, if you're saying that you take biblical interpretation seriously, if you take the Bible seriously, I think you need to take seriously that the Bible disagrees with itself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You need to take seriously that it's a conversation.
That is, I mean, I'm going to say that is an obvious point that needs to be made again and again and again. And I say that because it's very hard for some people to hear. Now, there's some people who are not ready to hear that, and that's fine. But there are some people who are right on the edge saying, I'm going to fall one way or the other here. And I think that's actually very encouraging for people to hear, you know, who are in that place where this is going to help them to stay in that that conversation with this tradition.
Absolutely. Yeah. All of the Bible requires interpretation. And so it really is a matter of, you know, in community with people you trust whose lives look like the person they're following, supposedly Jesus. I think that is kind of, you know, taking an approach of humility and saying, how can I take in even more insights from other people who are genuine humans? I mean, all of us have something I think we can add to the conversation here. Right. And that doesn't mean we all get, you know, weighted the same, and that's okay. But everybody should get to speak. It's okay, you know, for everybody to have an opinion and a voice. And sometimes we see things in a text because of our particular situation that somebody else wouldn't see. And it's there. Yeah, it is in the text, right? It was there the whole time, and we just overlooked it.
Yeah.
And so I am really advocating for both the spiritual autonomy to do that work, to kind of own your own perspective and voice, and the humility to do that in community with other people who probably know a lot more than you, right? Or who have a completely different take on the same scripture. You know, what does that teach you about God and about yourself and about how you can be a human that looks like Jesus in this world?
I was going to ask you if you had any closing thoughts about what to take away from all this, but I think you just did it.
I got you, Pete.
You nailed it. That's really great. So, I, you're advocating a certain freedom in looking at the Bible and engaging God, and again, not to be too simplistic, but not from a perspective mainly of some type of fear, but from a place of wonder and in that sense dependence, and that is an authority. When you give yourself over to that, it's a mystery that can be known, but it's a mystery nonetheless. And so thanks for writing this book, which I really enjoyed.
And
when did it come out? What month did it
January
come out? Oh, way back in January. Boy, this is waited too long to do this. So anyway,
you know what, it's a pleasure to get to talk to you whenever it happens.
Yeah, I got you. So, right, Liz. Well, thank you for being here. It's been wonderful.
You're so welcome.
I'm glad we had the chance to talk a little bit more about your wonderful book.
Thank you, Pete. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want an all-access pass to our classes, ad-free podcast, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebiblefornormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of Faith for Normal People. Don't forget you can catch our other show, The Bible for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team.